My name is John Pranger, and today we have a special guest by the name of David Crow, and he'll be phoning in about 40 minutes after the hour, and we'll be talking about his website, which re-examines the AIDS hypothesis, or the HIV-AIDS hypothesis. And before that, at the beginning of the show, we're going to hear a repeat of an interview that I had with Ted Kuntz, who was a psychotherapist in private practice in Vancouver, with a master's degree in counseling psychology and 25 years of clinical experience. His child was severely damaged by a DPT shot when he was a few months old, and Ted is going to be talking about that to us. We'll replay that interview, and then we're going to have a discussion with David afterwards about that interview and about Stephen Lewis and his campaign on behalf of AIDS victims, or perhaps it's only in aid of drug companies. And the two definitions of AIDS that concern the population of Africa and the different definition of AIDS, which is routine everywhere else in the world. And David is going to be commenting on that and how he was barred from protesting at the University of Calgary. Well, let's introduce Ted Kuntz, who, as I said, is a psychotherapist in private practice in Vancouver with a master's degree in counseling psychology and 25 years of clinical experience. He's recognized internationally for his work in assisting individual family organizations and corporations manage the challenges and opportunities and stresses of life more effectively. But much of the wisdom that Ted shares in his counseling workshops and books didn't come from his formal training. Rather, it came from his personal journey as the father of a child with disabilities. His best-selling book, Peace Begins With Me, is a summary of the wisdom he acquired on his journey, and this deeply personal story is an inspiration to anyone who wishes to move past pain and anger and return to a life of peace and joy. He's actively involved in the community on the board of directors with numerous local and national organizations, including Crossroads Hospice Society, Global Peace Hut, Kind Acts Society, Planned Lifetime Advocacy Network, Planned Institute for Citizenship and Disability, Philia, and the Pocomo Youth Services Society, and many other things. He was nominated as the Chamber of Commerce Citizen of the Year for 2006, so a very accomplished man and a very fine man, as I gathered from his interview. Well, let's the vaccine that damaged his child was the DPT vaccine, diphtheria and tetanus toxoid and pertussis vaccine, adsorbed, and it's made with by Wyeth. Well, I'll tell you what's a little bit in these shot. The insert admits that death is among the possible reactions, that crib death in particular. And in addition to this hazard, there are also abscesses at the site of the vaccination, fevers up to 105 degrees, collapse with prolonged prostration and shock, convulsions, brain damage, and permanent retardation, screaming syndrome, in which the baby screams with pain steadily for hours, day and night, stopping only when it collapses in coma from exhaustion and shock. And the worst reaction of all, of course, is a sudden infant death, or cribbed as SIDS, as I just said. Now, the packet insert states that DPT shots should be started at 2 months of age and continued at stated intervals to 6 years of age. And records show that most of the crib deaths occur between 2 months to 4 months of age. So I wonder how the doctors can continue to claim that they don't know the cause of crib deaths. Does this vaccination practice sound like something the government should continue to sanction and force on all the children of the country just so the vaccine boys can keep a steady inflow of money filling their bulging bank accounts? The final product contains 0.02% free formaldehyde. It contains casein, hydrolysate medium with yeast, dialysate, agar, charcoal, and the preservative, of course, is thimerosal, which is a mercury derivative. And during processing, hydrochloric acid and sodium hydroxide are used to adjust the pH. Sodium chloride is added to the final product to control isotonicity. Well, here are some of the serious and occasionally fatal adverse reactions that have been reported following administration of pertussis vaccine-containing preparations. Severe temperature elevations, as I said, 105 degrees, collapse with rapid recovery, collapse followed by prolonged prostration and a shock-like state, screaming episodes characterized by a prolonged period of peculiar crying during which the infant can't be comforted, isolated convulsion with or without fever, encephalopathy. With changes in the level of consciousness, focal neurological signs, and convulsions with or without permanent neurological and mental deficits. The occurrence of sudden death infant death syndrome has been reported following administration of DTP. It says that the significance of the reports is unclear. How this interest can say that it's beyond me. It should be kept in mind that the three primary immunizing doses of DTP are usually administered to infants between the ages of 2 and 6 months, and that approximately 85% of SIDS cases occur in the period 1 through 6 months of age, with the peak incidence at age 2 to 4 months. All right, let's hear that interview with Ted Kuntz, and then we'll be back with David Crow.
Wonderful, thank you. And now John is going to ask you a few questions.
Great.
Hi, John. Ted. It's good to hear from you. Now, your son Josh was affected by a vaccine shot at the age of 5 months, I understand, and he developed an uncontrollable seizure disorder that's left him with the capacity of a two-year-old.
That's correct, yeah.
And he now needs 24-hour care. Could you tell us your story, perhaps briefly, and why was it a vaccine, and how do you know that?
Well, it's a good question, and I don't have scientific proof to back it up, which is the weakness of it. But as a parent, I can tell you that my son was not the same son that came home after going to the pediatrician for his first vaccine shot as went. Josh became agitated following his shot, and his agitation increased.
How soon after the shot?
Well, we noticed immediately that he was agitated, and the agitation increased, and he actually didn't seize until about 21 or 22 days after the shot, but we actually took him back to his doctor twice in that space in between to say there's something wrong, or our son's not the same son, there's something amiss, and they would just say, well, you know, maybe he's reactive, but just give him Tylenol and everything would be fine.
Okay.
And then about day 23 or so, he had his first grand mal seizure. It was about 25 minutes long. Took him to the emergency of the local hospital. They prescribed some anti-seizure medication, sent us on our way, and said, you know, don't worry, everything will be fine. Well, that wasn't to be the case. A month later, Josh seized again, a month later again, and eventually the seizuring increased in frequency such that by the time he was four, he was seizing 12 to 15 times a day.
And how old was he when he got the shot?
4 months. It was his first vaccine shot, his first DPT, pertussis, whooping cough, polio, tetanus, diphtheria.
Wow. That's a whole lot of bacteria and viruses. Now, was there... The reaction of the health authorities was very minimal, as though they had never experienced such a thing before, and as if they had 100% complete confidence that it would not be the vaccine, it must be something else, or a very mild reaction, but certainly nothing serious.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the typical response. We had said over and over again in the beginning that we thought that it was because of the vaccine, and it just, when you say that, it would just fall on deaf ears. It would be as if they didn't hear it, and when I would begin to challenge them later, because I did a lot of research on vaccinations and vaccine damage because I wanted to understand what happened to my son, and what they admitted was, well, it doesn't make any sense to them, is that they wouldn't know what to do with it even if it was vaccine damage, because they wouldn't know how to treat it. They have no way of diagnosing whether it's vaccine damage or not. So it's just, they don't know what to do with that piece of information, so they simply ignore it.
But people do get compensated for these injuries, do they not, in Canada?
Well, no, not in Canada. We don't have a vaccine damage compensation plan.
Oh, so there's no acknowledgement at all, then?
That's right. Now, most of the major Western countries of the world all do have vaccine damage compensation plan. United States, Japan, Germany, France. And I actually began a group that I called Parents of Vaccine Damaged Children, and one of the tasks that we did was got copies of these compensation plans, and we crafted one that we sent off to Ottawa, and they basically said there is no political will to enact something like this, and so it just fell on deaf ears.
Now, the United States, I know they do give out vast sums of money, I think it's in the billions, which is a tacit acknowledgement that vaccines do cause damage.
That's right, yeah.
And, in fact, did your reading tell you that many epidemic outbreaks have occurred as a result of vaccination?
Yeah, absolutely, and I mean, that was one of the things that I learned is, as I dug into it, I began to realize that what they were saying and the facts were different, and I felt completely disillusioned with it. And it was one of those times of grief, I think, that you experience when you realize that something that you found to be core was not, in fact, true. One of the things that I eventually learned is that no vaccine has successfully gone through a long-term double-blind study to prove either safety or effectiveness. And it took me a few years before I finally came to that conclusion. And then I wrote to the people like Center for Disease Control and my family physician and the director of the health unit of my community. And I said, you know, obviously you believe in this program, you believe in vaccination, so show me the evidence. Show me a long-term double-blind study. And they admitted that, in fact, it doesn't exist.
Wow.
And what I would get back is these letters that say, well, everybody knows that they're safe and effective. And I said, that's not science. Now, that's religion, and if we want to have a religion about vaccinations, you know, then I can choose not to join that religion. But what I became resentful about is they hid behind the notion that they were scientific and that this is scientific practice, and yet when I scratched below to find the science, you find that it really is not there.
So were you angry about that, Ted, or are you still
angry
about it?
And that's what my book really is about, is that journey, because the first 5 years of Josh's life, when I was watching my son diminish before my eyes and losing his capacity to walk and talk and to feed himself and do all those things, I was angry, I was resentful, and they had warned us that any one of the seizures had the potential to kill him because of how challenging it was to him. And so I lived in this constant state of fear, and I spent a good 5 years of Josh's life living that way, and then I realized this is just a crazy way to live life. It's too hard. I realized I wasn't being much of a father when I was stuck in my anger, my fear. I wasn't being much of a husband or employee or citizen of the community. And so I finally made a vow to turn that around and make peace with life.
Now, you're a psychotherapist trained in scientific protocol. You know what's scientific and what is not.
I do.
You have a right to criticize with your background and to be taken seriously. How many people have been damaged, have suffered such damage, and, you know, because they were not educated people, or at least not educated in a scientific way, that they are given short shrift and told to go home and never mind and suffer your troubles. And of course, you have started a group that allows people with disabilities to survive their parents without becoming ward to the state or tossed aside as refuse. Can you tell us about that initiative of yours about ensuring the lifetime upkeep of your child and that of other children like him?
Well, it's a group called PLAN. It began here in Vancouver, and I actually wasn't part of the original group that started it. It was actually a group that was senior to me. They were more elderly. They were in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, and what they had in common is they all had a son or a daughter with a disability. And one of the things that they recognized is that it was likely that their children would outlive them, and that's something that's relatively new in Canadian society, that individuals with a disability will outlive their parents. So they were concerned about, well, who's going to take care of my son or my daughter after
right.
I'm gone?
Yes.
And one of the things that I recognize, too, is that my responsibility to my son doesn't stop when I die. It stops when he dies. And yes. if he outlives me, as I hope he does, then my challenge is, how do I take care of him when I'm gone? And we know that the government will provide food and shelter and those basic qualities of life, but they tend not to be able to provide the things that really make life good, relationships, ensuring the capacity for choice, making sure that you're living in a place that feels like home, allowing you to have enough financial resources to live in dignity. And so PLAN began, and their first question was, who will take care of my son or my daughter after I'm gone? After a few years of meeting and talking about what they could do as parents, they changed the question to, what is a good life? And what they came to recognize is that a good life involves five components. It involves having a home, whether you own it or not, but the fact that you have a place that feels like a sanctuary, that's safe, that you're in relationships with people who know you and love you and care about you, and the relationships are reciprocal, that your capacity for choice is honored, so that means that you have people around you who will honor your choice and know how to communicate with you so that you can express choice, that you have financial dignity, and the last piece that they came to recognize is contribution, that all of us, in order to feel a valuable member of community, need to make a contribution. And most people with disability have been precluded from making a contribution, either because we felt like they had nothing to give or that they weren't in relationships where they actually could give those contributions.
I'm looking at a picture of your son, and it really makes me sad, but there are, it's not just seizures, there are other deformities that come about in the body. Do you need to take care of him in many, many ways? For example, the teeth, they seem to change strangely from that of a normal human being to something else. Do you concur with that?
Well, I know that Josh's, his teeth have changed over the years, and some of that is because of the number of falls from seizures that he's had, and he's lost teeth that way. And it's hard to give him the kind of dental care that he requires just because he doesn't tolerate it well. And then in order to get proper care, you have to put him under a general anesthetic, which we're reluctant to do unless it's an emergency. So there are those things. You know, it just...
And what about his mental ability?
Well, like you said, Josh's capacity is about that of a two-year-old now. He was functioning up until about 3.5 or 4 years of age, and then because of the amount of seizures, he actually regressed and lost much of that ability. We're fortunate that he's at a two-year-old level because he still has a limited capacity to communicate with you. He's generally a pretty happy young man. But it is, we've had to learn that his life is different than we had hoped it would be for him.
Are you engaged in any way in seeing the outlawing of vaccination, or at least some looking into in a scientific way that will, I don't know what my question is really. Are you advocating at all for a change in this regimen that the medical establishment imposes on us and our children?
Well, you know, I was a strong advocate for a lot of years, and I invested a lot of energy into it and got, I think, exhausted by it. Probably what I would say where I'm at now is that I simply tell my story, and I want people to know that vaccines have the potential to cause damage. And people ask me all the time if they should vaccinate their children, and I say it's not my decision to make. My wish for you is that you make an informed decision, and so I can give you some information for you to go out there and learn about the potentially negative consequences. I think it's one of those tough decisions because we've been led to believe that if we don't vaccinate, that we're being irresponsible, that we're opening our children up to all kinds of horrible things that could make them ill or kill them.
And did you find any proof of that in your research?
Well, again, no vaccine has successfully proven that it's effective either, and I know that we've got all kinds of wonderful stories about, you know, how, for example, the polio vaccine and how it changed the world and what a gift it was. Well, I don't know if you're familiar, but a book came out about a year and a half ago called The Virus and the Vaccine, which actually tells the story of the polio vaccine, and it is one of the ugliest stories that you're going to come across in terms of greed and manipulation and politics. Mm-hmm. And what they knew is that the vaccine that they had developed actually caused all kinds of harm.
Yes.
They knew fairly quickly that it had simian viruses in it because it was made mm-hmm. with monkey tissue, and that those viruses caused cancer in humans. And yet, because of the political and the commercial interests that were there, they continued to go ahead and vaccinate people, even though they knew that it was dangerous.
And they're all over the world trying to eradicate it, so-called.
Yeah, and they believe now that 100 million people in North America were vaccinated with a polio vaccine that was tainted with simian viruses that cause cancer.
Cancer of the brain now.
Yeah.
Yes. Showing up in people who have had that vaccination.
Yeah.
And both Sabin and Salk accuse each other of murder.
<That's right.
laughs> Hazel has a question for you.
Hi, Hazel.
Hi, Ted. you have a beautiful story about how your son contributes to society. I know a lot of people, I work with disabled children, and they say, oh, they don't, disabled people do not contribute to society. And perhaps you'd like to share that beautiful story that I just heard recently.
I'd love to. It's one of my favorite stories about Josh. And it came at a time in my life when I didn't fully appreciate my son's contribution. One of the things that I've come to recognize that in our society we tend to measure contribution by what people can do. And my son, because of his because of what had happened, he wasn't able to do very much. And then I had the good fortune of having Josh's grade 7 teacher who helped me to see my son different. And the story is about when Josh was going into grade 7. In that particular year, he was attending a middle school in Port Coquitlam, and there was enough students that year for two grade 7 classes. And it just so happened that both teachers were men, and both were crazy about their sports. And in August, they did something a little unusual as a way of dividing up the students for their respective classes. And what they did is they flipped a coin, and then they alternated picks back and forth, much like they were choosing players on a team. And Jeff won the coin toss, and he looked over this list of about 70 students, and after a few moments of reflection, he chose my son with his first pick. And the other teacher was quite mystified by this, and he said to Jeff, "Jeff, like, I don't get it. You know, Josh has the capacity of a two-year-old. He has an uncontrolled seizure disorder. He'll need to have all of his curriculum modified. He'll need to be toileted. You'll have to be vigilant with his care so that he doesn't hurt himself when he seizes." And on that list, there are kids that are very bright kids, good-looking kids, funny kids, great athletes. Like, so tell me why you would choose a child with disabilities with your first pick. And like I said, Jeff was one of those amazing people, and he saw my son different. And he said, "Well, let me tell you what I've noticed around the school the last couple of years." He said, "I've noticed Josh. Josh is hard not to see. But I also noticed the other kids around Josh, and I noticed how eager they greeted him when he came into the school in the morning, how they wanted to take turns to push him in his chair, how they would work through an assignment quickly so that they could read to him while the other kids were finishing, how they would alternate or how they would modify a game at recess or gym to include Josh in the game, how they would assist him with eating his lunch, how they would hold his hand or stroke his forehead after he had a seizure to comfort him. And what I notice is that the children are kinder and gentler when they're around Josh. And so I think that if I have Josh in my class, it will make it a kinder and gentler place for all kids to learn." And so what I learned from that is that Jeff saw Josh's gift, and Josh's gift was not what he did, but his way of being in that room. And his way of being allowed children, the other children, to be kinder and gentler. And Josh does that. He does draw out people's humanity. And I think that's what people with disability really do, is that they give us an opportunity to be caring and compassionate and loving.
That's just such a beautiful story, and thank you so much for sharing it.
Thank you for asking.
Yes, I wish the government would be as caring and as kind.
Well, you know, what I see is that the government, there are things that they can do and they can do well, and there are things that they can't do well. And I think that they're not able to develop relationships for people with disabilities. And yet what we know is that relationships is really what gives life quality, what it gives it richness. We also know that that's what keeps people safe. They did some research a number of years ago to look at what keeps people with disabilities safe, and they thought it might have to do with the number of social workers or the size of their caseload or the number of bylaw enforcement officers or police officers or something like that. And much to their surprise, what they learned was that what keeps people safe is actually the number of relationships that they have. The more relationships, the safer they are. The fewer relationships, the more vulnerable they are. And so knowing that, it means that we have to intentionally facilitate relationships for people with a disability if we want them to be safe. And yet that's not part of the government mandate. They don't see that as a primary purpose in their intervention. And I believe that they need to. They need to broaden the way that they build a safety net around people with disability. They need to include the importance of relationships.
Thanks, Ted. You know, getting back to the scientific aspects of these things, about 92%, this is reported by the Food and Drug Administration, 92% of drugs and vaccines that test successfully in animals fail during human trials, and that over half of the 8% that are approved get relabeled or withdrawn due to serious adverse effects. So there's absolutely no way to tell from the animal test what it will do to a human being. But they're relying on that entirely and not on clinical trials.
Yeah.
So it's the violence, of course, that happens in this institution spills over, and we have to pay for these crimes somehow. And of course, we're all caught up in the fates and in the karma of the human race, and it strikes willy-nilly. And your son was a victim of that violence that occurs on a very, very in a very hidden place and on a very basic level of the whole medical edifice, you see. So your own experience or your own education may have brought you into contact with animal research. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, see, I would agree with you. When I spent 10 years reading everything I could get my hands on vaccinations and the research that was out there, and what I realized is how much of that research was actually flawed, how they would design the research in such a way to get the kind of results that they wanted. And so they were more invested in having the research, having the drug out on the market, than actually producing something that was safe or effective. And it's discouraging when you come to realize how much sometimes the corporate agenda gets in the way of just being good human beings. But what I've come to accept is that at least is where the human species is at this time in our evolution, and we've got a lot of maturing to do.
What about your own education? Did you encounter the lab at all?
I had to learn how to do statistics and how to read research and that kind of stuff. But in terms of actually being in the lab, that wasn't something I was exposed to as part of my degree.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, I think it's a gigantic fraud, and we're all suffering from its effects. And I really applaud you for what you've done in your life to ameliorate the condition of your son. And I hope you'll keep on fighting for people with disabilities and against the whole regimen that the medical establishment is now imposing on us and our children in terms of vaccines and other kinds of drugs that are now being imposed by anti-terrorist legislation virtually.
Yeah. Well, and to me it's really about educating people and helping people to take the responsibility for their decision making. I mean, one of the what I realized with my son is that out of my desperation I was basically turning him over to the medical profession, saying, do whatever you need to do to make him better. And then after I realized that they were actually doing harm to him, at some point I finally said, listen, that's enough. And you know, needed to step away and take back the responsibility of making decisions for my son. So when they would come and want to do blood work or something, I'd say, tell me what that's about. And they would often say, oh, it's just routine, you know. And I'd say, well, if it's routine, explain it to me. I want to make that decision. And I wasn't a very cooperative patient for
a few
years.
Oh, you better not
there.
Be these days, yeah.
But I think that it's important for us to make sure that we are the decision makers, that we use the profession, doctors and as consultants to educate us, and then we decide. And I think that's exactly what needs to happen with vaccinations, is that we need to gather information, and then we have to own the decision. And so a responsible parent needs to make sure that they have enough information so that they can make an informed decision. And that's hard to do, because the information out there is quite biased, I believe, and it's hard to find information that is critical of a vaccination program.
Thank you very much, Ted.
Excuse me. I just have to... I'm the operator, Alan, here.
Hi.
We just had a caller, and the caller was asking about the plan. You were referring to a plan earlier on.
Yeah.
And I wanted some information so she could find out more about it.
Plan is an organization, again, that began in Vancouver. We actually have affiliates in about a dozen cities across Canada. If she wants to, or if the caller wants to learn more about Plan, they have a website, and it's www.plan.ca.
And your website is peacebeginswithme.ca?
That's correct.
Okay.
And that will tell a little bit about my story, my journey with Josh, and if people are interested in my book, they can order it right off the website.
Thank you very much, Ted.
A pleasure.
Well, let me leave you with this thought. We need to abolish animal experimentation, too, in order for these things to not... so that there's no possibility of these kinds of things happening.
Well, we need to treat everybody, all living beings, with more respect and dignity than we are.
Thank you. That is precisely my sentiment.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again, perhaps.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And that was an interview that I did last week on Animal Voices with Ted Koontz. And we're going to take a little break, and then we'll be back with David Crowe.
All right.
Bye now.
CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. My name is John Pranger, and this is Dynamic Health. Well, our next guest is David Crowe. Before we do that, before we get to David, I'm going to read a couple of things here, and that is about how vaccines are made. And I'm quoting from the California Health Digest, and it's very hard to get information about these things because it's a very secretive industry, apparently. I mean, it's very hard even to get the insert for vaccines to see what possible contraindications are. And there's also very little information about how these vaccines are made. But this is from the California Health Digest, and it says, in making anti-rabies serum, it is practically the same as Pasteur made it. A dog is strapped down, and after cutting into the skull, a sharp instrument punctures the bone. And with 30 turns of a circular saw, an opening is made exposing the brain. Into the brain is injected the virus of rabies. The head is then stitched, and the suffering animal is returned to its cage to die in agony after 30 days of intense suffering. The diseased spinal cord is then dried and prepared for injection into people. Meanwhile, the brain of the dog is processed to be injected into the brains of other animals. Well, from that, is it any wonder that the rabies shots cause death or various lingering diseases of body poisoning? Sometimes rabbits are used to make rabies vaccine. This is from the Vaccination Inquirer. The skull of a live rabbit is pierced with a scalpel and a small quantity of rabies virus injected. The animal is placed in a cage that has a tag bearing the date on which it was inoculated. The first symptoms of rabies in rabbits begins with the paralyzing of the hind legs and generally works forward until the animal dies of general paralysis. The vaccine is prepared by pulverizing the spinal cord. Well, no matter what process is used to make the vaccine, the result is the same, as it always poisons the bloodstream of the one who receives the vaccine, and that poisoning comes also in the form of known and unknown viruses, which can have known and unknown effects, because really medicine is working on the wrong premise, the germ theory, and so things work in reverse action, causing disease rather than curing it. My name is John Pranger. This is Dynamic Health on CFRO 102.7 FM. My guest now is David Crowe. Hi, David. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
There we go. All right. Well, you heard the interview, and we want to talk with you today about the definition of AIDS and about your encounter with Stephen Lewis, who is more or less kind of an AIDS guru, I suppose you could call him. What did you think, first of all, of the story of Ted Koontz? It's rather typical and very sad, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's typical in a number of ways. I mean, one is the amount of damage that allopathic medicine can do. And secondly, when you challenge it, it becomes an issue of faith. You're supposed to know that it's the only approach to healthcare, and you know, the fact that there's no scientific evidence to show that vaccines are safe and effective is not supposed to bother you. But I think the people that look into it carefully get extremely bothered. But society is so brainwashed that, 90% of the people you talk to are shocked when you claim that, vaccines are not effective, or that, a certain disease that they believe is viral is not.
Yeah, well, the public is very little interested in medicine because, of course, we have so many miracles, it's hard to keep track of them all.
Yeah.
David, do you want to talk a little bit about who you are and your background and the group that you work with? Because my computer is down, I can't get any information.
Oh, okay. Yes. I founded the Alberta Reappraising AIDS Society in 1999, and this was due to my growing interest in the ideas of some scientists who had questioned whether HIV causes AIDS or not. By 1999, I had already seen not only the damage that AIDS drugs could do, the psychological damage that the diagnosis itself could do, but I'd seen how people who refused to cooperate with the system would be abused. I think back then the case that was freshest in my mind was the case of Sophie Brassard in Montreal. She had two children. She was HIV positive and quite healthy. She had two children that she did not want to have medicated. In the end, the state, the province, took the children from her, and they went, I think, to her father, where the state insisted he agreed to medicate them. She would not. In the end, Sophie died, and I think it was, you've probably heard stories of when an animal is hunted and it just drops dead in the forest from a heart attack because it's so scared from the trauma of being hunted that it's not actually shot by the hunters but just dies.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happened to Sophie. I mean, she took her children, she kidnapped her own children and went to Africa. She got sick. She found it difficult to work over there, and look after her children. So she ended up coming back, but she was, her body and mind and spirit were broken by the time she came back. So that was extremely traumatic for me, and so I decided that I would want to do something about that, to form a society, to start putting information on the internet regarding the flaws in the science surrounding HIV and AIDS. And I think now I have one of the biggest databases of scientific information, which is presented on the website as a list of quotations directly from scientific papers, categorized by topic. So if you want to know about false positive HIV tests, if you want to know about the danger of AIDS drugs to mothers and pregnant women, you know, those are categories that you can look at, and you can see the raw science, the publications, and you can see the flaws, not through my words or the words of other dissidents in this area, but through scientists who believe the theory but record some of the anomalies.
Okay, and tell us about your run-in with the University of Calgary, and especially your run-in with Stephen Lewis.
Yeah, well, Stephen Lewis was coming to Calgary as part of some leadership training course, and so I had, you know, written to the people who were organizing it and asked if I could come and ask a question of Stephen Lewis, and they denied me that. So I wrote back to them and said, well, would Stephen Lewis answer in writing one question that I put to him? And they said no, it would be inappropriate to do this. So anyway, he came a little later to speak to a group at the University of Calgary. It wasn't sponsored by the university, but it was at the university campus. And so with a friend, I went out there, and I had some pamphlets, and they had, you know, just some statements like AIDS drugs are toxic, and then it gave an address on the society webpage regarding toxicity of AIDS drugs, and HIV tests are not accurate, and it gave a URL, and it had a little bit of other information on there. And we stood in the lobby, and we handed out these pink pieces of paper with, you know, basically a bunch of website addresses on and a couple of paragraphs of information. They didn't notice us. It was actually very successful because they didn't notice us for about 15 minutes. But then they realized that we were not part of the system. They asked us to leave, and we said we believed in freedom of speech, and we weren't planning on leaving. And then they got the security guards out, and you know, we were basically harassed to the point that we left. And we were told that if we came back on the University of Calgary campus within 24 hours, we would be arrested, which I thought said a lot about freedom of speech and universities in the current climate.
And also that the police would be very concerned to come and bust you rather than some drive-by shooting or other major crimes that occur every day in our city.
That's exactly right. I'm not sure the police would have been too enthusiastic about arresting somebody for the crime of freedom of speech, but these days that seems to be one of the biggest crimes. Certainly some the U.S. government feels that way, and the current Canadian government seems to feel very similarly that you know, people who speak up are not welcome.
Now, Stephen Lewis doesn't publish any adverse reactions, any hint of anything being wrong with these drugs that he is virtually marketing for them.
I just went on his website today, and I searched for the phrase adverse effect.
Yeah.
I got zero hits. I searched for side effect. I got zero hits. I searched for liver because, you know, liver failure is a big side effect of many AIDS drugs, and I found lots of occurrences of the word deliver. He seems to like the word deliver, like time to deliver, but he doesn't like the liver, which is the target for AIDS drugs. But when I searched for life-saving drugs, I counted at least 15 occurrences where he said that antiretroviral drugs were life-saving. And I don't know how drugs that have a toxic and fatal side effect can be considered life-saving without qualification. I mean, maybe on balance, you could say they're life-saving, but they kill some people. But he's not saying that. He's calling them life-saving. From what you would gather from his website, there's nothing wrong with these drugs at all.
And what about his sponsors, or how about the people who fund his... Yeah, you can't get anywhere in this world without funding. I know that from a very bitter experience being part of a anti-vivisection society. You know, $5 here, $10 there.
Right.
But
well,
this guy commands millions.
Stephen gets a lot of money, and in I wrote to the Canadian government, and cause he has a charity called the Stephen Lewis Foundation, and I asked for his financial statement for the year 2003, which I believe was his first full year of operation. And he had $1 million in donations that year, which is a little bit more than the $5 here and there. And I was communicating with some of his employees and trying to find out a little bit about the donations. And they were, of course, saying, well, we can't give you names of people who donated. And I said, I don't want that. I'd just like to know the categories, like how much came from drug companies, how much came from foundations, the government, from private citizens. That's what I want to know. Just give me the categories and how much was in each category. The only useful information they gave me was that the largest donation was $100,000.
That's very considerable.
Yes. And but they wouldn't tell me what it was, where it was from. And then after this little demonstration at the University of Calgary, I got an email from Stephen Lewis, the only communication I've ever had with him, where he said that he had instructed his staff not to ever communicate with me again.
That's a pretty strong reaction for a simple question.
Well, it wasn't. It was the fact that I had embarrassed him at a at a speaking engagement by handing out alternative literature. I think that was really what it was, and it became an excuse, I think, for him not to talk to me about his financial information. You know, he didn't want to. I don't think they had any plans to tell me anything, but of course, this was a good thing to say, you know, you're a radical. We're not going to talk to you at all. So we don't. We're not hiding. But there's no information on who the donors are. There wasn't at that time on his website. Now there's a little bit of information because I think they got $1 million donation from the big newspaper. I think it's from the Aspers.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So they're talking about that, but yeah, that doesn't mean they're not still getting money from drug companies. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. I suspect that they are because Stephen Lewis acts like a drug company salesman.
Yes, he sure does. And his enthusiasm and his verbosity, some people call it eloquence, I say it's verbosity.
Yeah. Yes. He's like a preacher. And, you know, this is a faith-based initiative, this whole AIDS thing. You're supposed to take his words on faith. You're supposed to accept that people are dying of AIDS in Africa, and I think we'll be able to talk about the definition of AIDS in Africa, and that the drugs are life-saving. So they have this fatal illness. We've got these life-saving drugs. It's a pretty simple story he's spinning for people around the world who haven't investigated this.
You think that the donors would be very proud to have their names up in lights?
Well, that's what I thought. I went to some other websites, you know, like the Toronto Sick Children's Hospital, and, you know, a lot of these organizations have, like, a special web page with their donors. You know, I go to the symphony or the opera, and there's a page in the manual or in the program that has the donors and, you know, which ones are in the $1,000 category and which ones are in the $100 category. Everybody's very proud to have their name at the back of the program. I mean, some people are anonymous, but there's sure. obviously a lot of people who want to have their name up there.
So there's something very suspect about David Lewis not wanting to.
Stephen Lewis
says it's a matter of privacy.
Well, that's fine, but he should still produce at least, you know, the categories of the organizations or people who are giving him money.
Absolutely.
And a simple question, are you taking money from drug companies? I think it's extremely important to be answered.
And we're all looking for transparency in these organizations lately because of the many times that we've been stung by, you know, Enron-type accounting and so on, and by charities who raise a lot of funds and don't really account for them.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, these charities can... Everybody thinks charity and they're doing good, but in many cases, the charity is a financial instrument that can be used to funnel money to certain people. Like out here, a lot of laser eye clinics are formed as charities. Well, that doesn't mean they're run for free. They may give, you know, some eye surgery for free, and that's very good. But the people who essentially own the charity are the doctors, and you know, they're probably getting fees as a member of the board and, you know, fees for each surgery and things like that. So it's totally a profit-making venture for the doctors, but it's structured as a charity, which probably gives them all kinds of tax benefits. You know, it's not because they entirely want to do good.
Oh, yeah. Well, the former head of the FDA has just been fined several thousands of dollars for a conflict of interest there, and that speaks volumes because that organization is one of the most corrupt on the planet, in my view. Tell us about the definition of AIDS as according to the World Health Organization, and tell us for Africa, and tell us then what the different definition is for AIDS in places other than Africa, and how is it that science can be so malleable as a consequence of artificial borders?
Well, the definition of AIDS is probably one of the most critical issues, because when people talk about AIDS, they don't really know what they're talking about. They know people are dying of it. They know it's transmitted by a virus, and they know that it's like a fatal virus, that everybody gets the virus, dies. But, you know, if you ask them, what exactly are they dying of, they probably couldn't tell you. And in Africa, the Bangui definition is used. And it's called that because in 1986, the World Health Organization, the CDC, and others got together in the city of Bangui in Central Africa, and they established this definition. And although there are different definitions in Africa, they're all essentially the same. It's very small differences between the national definitions. So basically, they break AIDS symptoms into three categories. They call them the major signs, of which there's only three, which is a weight loss of more than 10% of body weight, chronic diarrhea for over a month, and a prolonged fever for more than a month, although it does not have to be consistently for a month. So you could have a fever at the beginning of the month and the end of the month, and that would qualify as prolonged fever. And then there are minor signs, starting with persistent cough, generalized pruritic dermatitis, and a few other things. Now, to get a diagnosis of AIDS, you need two major signs, one minor sign, and no HIV test. So what they have done in Africa is they have redefined malaria, tuberculosis, and malnutrition, and a number of other conditions, as AIDS. And instead of nutritious food, clean water, basic medical care, what you need are expensive antiretroviral drugs. Mm-hmm. And one of the most damaging thing about the antiretroviral drugs is that they cause anemia. And, of course, many Africans have anemia because of malaria, because of parasitic infections such as hookworm infections. So these drugs are more dangerous in Africa than anywhere else in the world. And, in fact, even Stephen Lewis was quoted in a Chinese news agency recently as being concerned about the high death rate in Malawi in people starting antiretroviral programs, although that hasn't stopped his running around the world talking about life-saving drugs.
And anemia and severe anemia is one of the certain outcomes of treatment with AZT, is it?
That's correct. In fact, most AIDS journals would have a full-page glossy advertisement for a drug, it's not really a drug, called Procrit, which is erythropoietin, which is a blood-stimulating enzyme. That's one of the best-selling medical compounds in the world, is this thing called Procrit. And it's specifically advertised for patients using AZT. So it says in the advertisement, Procrit is useful for patients suffering AZT-induced anemia. And that's in just about every AIDS
really,
journal.
Really? So one drug to counteract the toxic effects of another, and that's more or less the whole yo-yo game that goes on in medical science today. You know, you put one drug on the market, and 10 more have to be used to counteract the effects of that damn drug.
Yeah, that's how the system works. And, of course, that makes the system very profitable. If you were a doctor who said, you know, you need to eat better, get more exercise, more fresh fruits and vegetables, you wouldn't do very well. But if you gave people drugs that cause side effects, that cause the people to come back, you know, you're generating a lot of business. And, you know, I don't think doctors do that intentionally, but what it means is that the doctors that produce the most sickness produce the most business. So those are the ones who are very successful.
Sure. Yes, when their profits depend on sick people, then the more sick people, the better.
Yes.
And if you can make people artificially sick, well then,
yes,
let's give that a try.
Maybe we should talk about the definition of AIDS in Canada and the United States.
Yeah.
In Canada, the definition of AIDS is about 30 different diseases, which are either infections or cancers, and usually the presence of an HIV test, although some diseases like Kaposi's sarcoma, which is a kind of skin cancer, can result in an AIDS diagnosis without an HIV test. So basically, in Canada, you need to be sick and you need to have an HIV test. Canada, by the way, has very few AIDS cases. There's something like about 200 new cases a year in a population of around 30 million. So it's a tiny, tiny problem in terms of how the mainstream defines.
Well, more people are killed by NSAID, the nonsteroidal, whatever they are, painkillers, in other words, aspirin, that sort of thing,
yeah.
Ibuprofen, then are killed by AIDS. So.
Yeah, I mean, there was a study in the U.S. that estimated that 106,000 people a year are killed in the United States by properly prescribed pharmaceutical drugs in hospitals. So that would be about 10,000 people in Canada. So you put 208 new AIDS cases in Canada against the 10,000 a year killed by pharmaceutical drugs. Mm-hmm. And then those are AIDS cases, and the number of deaths is smaller than that. It's around 100 a year. So it's a really tiny problem. But the interesting difference between Canada and the United States, one of them, is the definition of AIDS. The definition I described in Canada is also applicable in the United States, but there's one addition. In the United States, if you have a low CD4 cell immune count plus a positive HIV test, in the absence of any clinical illness, you will be defined as an AIDS patient. And by 1997, almost two-thirds of new AIDS cases were in that category, healthy people with two laboratory tests. And that's one of the reasons why the rate of AIDS in America per capita is 5 to 10 times that in Canada, depending on which statistic that you use. So two-thirds of the new cases in 1997 were in healthy people. And, of course, those people are put on AIDS drugs, and then they get sick, and then they die, and they become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And you might ask, well, why am I using 1997 statistics? Well, every year the Centers for Disease Control produces a surveillance report, which is a many-page document full of statistical reports on HIV and AIDS, and every year it's dumbed down. And in the 1998 report, they removed all the information on the number of healthy people who were being diagnosed as AIDS, probably because it was well over two-thirds of the new cases. By now, who knows, it could be 90% of new AIDS cases in America are in that category. We simply don't know. The CDC won't tell us.
Yeah, and meantime, vast amounts of money are being spent, and time is being allocated to finding out finding a vaccine, and there are many clinical trials that are happening now, and they want to actually shoot up everybody, every man, woman, and child with the AIDS virus, if they can, if they find them, and of course they're proving these things on monkeys, and then they go right into the clinic, and we don't even know what kind of injuries are being sustained there.
Yeah, they've certainly abused a lot of animals in AIDS research, and it's been quite futile. They've claimed that they were able to make one chimpanzee sick with AIDS, but given that AIDS is such a broad definition, they might just have been able to reduce the number of CD4 cells in the monkey, and you know, in a chimpanzee, pardon me. And
yeah, that's the music that tells us we pretty well have to go, David.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. I wish we had more time.
Well,
thanks,
we can do this
much.
Again.
Let's do that. Let's do that. I'll give you a call.
I had a lot of fun. Thank you for having me on the show.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye. And that's it, folks. I'm sorry you have to go. I just want to announce one event for America, Freedom to Fascism, from the monetary system to microchips, the documentary that they don't want you to see, the scariest film you'll see this year, makes Fahrenheit 9/11 look like Bambi. On Sunday, January 28th at 12:30 and 2:45 p.m., and Tuesday at January 30th, 7 p.m. and 9:15 p.m. at the Pacific Cinematheque, 1131 Howe Street, $10 or $8. You can get more information, 604-327-9140. And there's a free DVD compilation on related issues with entrance. That's 2 days only. So, America, Freedom to Fascism, Sunday, January 28th, and Tuesday, January 30th. This has been Dynamic Health on CFRO 102.7 FM. We'll talk to you again next week.